great that you could join the program today, and I hope you've enjoyed a happy week. We've been talking about the mind training slogans, which appear in the precepts section of the text, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, by the Tibetan master Namkar Pel. Last week, we started discussing the slogan, There are two activities at both beginning and end. Looking past the awkward English translation, we found Namkar Pel explaining it like this. You should set a strong resolve to eliminate unwholesome activities and acquire their antidotes. You should do this when you wake up every morning throughout your life. When you go to sleep at night, if you find that the behavior of your body and speech has been in accord with your resolve, you can rejoice, thinking that you're having found life as a free and fortunate human being, met with the teachings of the great vehicle, and come under the care of spiritual masters has been worthwhile. But if you have not done as you had resolved, reflecting that you have worthlessly wasted your leisure and opportunities, and that your meeting with a profound teaching has been without purpose, determine not to do the same in the future. In her commentary on www.tricycle.org, Judy Leaf is a little more forgiving when she says that if we find we haven't maintained awareness and bodhicitta well throughout the day, it is good to approach ourselves with some understanding. She says, the idea is not to beat yourself up for losing your sense of bodhicitta and mind training, nor is it to give yourself a medal for being good. You do not need to blame yourself or to blame anyone else. The idea is simply to take note so that you can shift your energy gradually in the direction of kindness and awareness. The practice of Lojong, that's mind training, is a lifelong journey, but that journey takes place one day at a time. You cannot do anything about the days gone by, and speculating about the future can be overwhelming and somewhat pointless. But you can look at each day as a practice period with a beginning and an end. So every morning you take a fresh start, and every evening you have a chance to appraise how you have done. But now, before we continue with the discussion, let's take a look at our motivation and make sure it is a worthwhile one with which to approach a Dharma discussion. Of course, all our activities, including thought, speech, and physical actions, need powerful positive motivations. But how many times do we actually stop and think about why we are doing something? Usually it's automatic. We have an urge, we act. Not much contemplation going on there. But part of the mind training is developing mindfulness, so it's good to think about motivation as much as we can, especially when engaging in a Dharma activity. So let's think about a bodhicitta motivation for our program today. That is, let this program become the cause for me to attain enlightenment so I can best benefit myself and all beings everywhere, or something like that. As I've said before, this is the best motivation because it has the welfare of all beings at heart. So let's pause for a moment and look within. Thank you. Going back to the slogan, Ken MacLeod, translating Jamyon Kontrol's The Great Path of Awakening, pauses it as, at the beginning and the end, two things to be done. The English here is only somewhat better than the Namkar Pel translation, but the commentary makes Namkar Pel's explanation a little easier to understand. Jamyon Kontrol says, at the beginning, as soon as you wake up in the morning, generate very strongly the impetus, today I shall keep the two bodhicittas with me. During the day, maintain them with continuous mindfulness. At the end, when you go to sleep in the evening, examine your thoughts and actions of the day. If there were infringements of bodhicitta, enumerate the instances and acknowledge them, and make a commitment that such will not occur in the future. If there have been no infringements, meditate joyfully, and pray that you and all other beings may be able to engage in bodhicitta even more effectively in the future. Practice these two activities regularly. Take the same approach to any infringements or violations of ordination. That's Jamyon Kontrol. And B. Alan Wallace's commentary in the 7-point mind training is more extensive. He translates the slogan as, there are two actions on two occasions, at the beginning and end. And he says, The third of the practices listed here is one very frequently quoted by Tibetan lamas and extremely important. The beginning occasion for each day is getting up in the morning. What is our first thought on waking up? We can all afford a couple of minutes in bed to prepare quietly for the day before jumping up and brushing our teeth. Sechibuwa suggests that an earnest practitioner of the mind training should at this point be setting motivation, resolving not to be polluted by self-centeredness for the course of the day. It's important to understand exactly what is meant by self-centeredness so that it is clearly demarcated when it arises in the mind during the day. I recognize this. I was looking at something similar just this morning. And then the teaching of the mind training can come flooding in. Again, don't be lenient with self-centeredness. Recognize this quality of mind that has brought us misery, discontent, anxiety, and frustration year after every year of this lifetime, not to speak of lifetimes before this, since time out of mind. Each morning, look at the day that is yet to unfold and really set up the aspiration not to succumb to the self-centeredness, not to value our own welfare as the priority in our daily activities. This is perfectly feasible transformation of the mind. Anticipate responding to others with concern and sensitivity for their well-being. Go into the day with this stance, and then be aware and introspectively alert in dealing with people during the day. Be aware of the quality of your mind as you work, drive, shop, take care of the children, and watch TV. In other words, having set the resolve, carry through. Not because the karmic results will injure us if we don't, but because we yearn to live a meaningful and contented life that opens up to greater and greater happiness for ourselves and others. Cherish that thought and motivation throughout the course of the day. If we cannot cultivate introspective alertness even during our busiest days, then we might as well discard that way of life because it's guaranteed to be meaningless. Get rid of it and do something different. Now, obviously, I'm not recommending suicide, but a change of lifestyle. Our children, spouse, and friends are not benefiting from it, and certainly we are not ourselves. What are we currently offering to our children in such a situation? The most emphatic lesson that children learn is not the words we say, but the substantial example that we demonstrate in the quality of our life. Those of us who claim to have no time for any kind of Dharma practice, whether teachings, meditation, or transforming daily actions into Dharma, have set for our children the poorest possible example. And unless they rebel, they will waste their own lives as we have encouraged them. Employment in service as a nurse, teacher, doctor, or monk may sometimes substitute for living a truly meaningful life. There is still a karmic benefit. Healing others is wholesome. But if the motivation is chiefly to earn a good living, the benefits are limited. We may enjoy the fruit of good health in a future life, for example, or meet with skilled doctors when we are sick ourselves. But meanwhile, we remain mentally imbalanced and miserable. There's no substitute for internal spiritual practice. At the end of the day, when we lie down ready to sleep, then again it's worth taking at least a few moments to look back and examine the events of the day. Remember the original resolve and recognize the occasions when self-centeredness and mental distortions arose and dominated our thoughts and perhaps our physical actions. Guilt has no place in this recognition. Interestingly, guilt has no translation in Tibetan, although remorse does. Simply recognize that we've engaged in actions motivated by self-centeredness that bring us harm, squandering the wonderful potential of this human life, damaging ourselves and others. And with that recognition, recall how to counteract the self-centeredness and mental distortion. There's no way to snap our fingers and be free of such unwholesome behavior, but we do know the antidotes. So, look to the future and say, there is something to avoid for everyone's welfare. This is not simply a matter of scrutinizing the unwholesome events like a judge. Recognize also the victories, the delights of implementing the spiritual practice, and the times when we acted with real cherishing of others. Look back and rejoice at the acts of service that were not calculated to elicit a reward or even gratitude. These acts are answers to the question of how we can make our life meaningful. Recognize occasions of insight when we have seen ourselves or others with the reification of an autonomous intrinsic identity. Rejoice in this cultivation of wisdom, because this also is a way to make life meaningful. Other commentaries on this verse frequently refer to cultivating the motivation before any endeavor. May this act as a cause for my full awakening for the benefit of all creatures. In other words, allow the relative bodhicitta to enter and provide the incentive for engaging in that endeavor, which tremendously enriches it. Then, at the conclusion of a wholesome action, or at the end of the day, look back and once again dedicate its merit to full awakening for the benefit of all beings, and to anything else that seems of great worth, such as peace on this planet. We can offer this merit or spiritual power, and we can keep on offering it. The more we offer, the more we have. That is B. Alan Wallace, and that last bit is a good instruction for us on how to set a good motivation in everything that we do, as we spoke about at the beginning of the program. And just to complement this teaching by Alan Wallace, let's finish our commentary on this slogan with the advice of Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche in his book Enlightened Courage, where he translates the slogan as two things to be done at the start and at the finish. He says, in the morning on waking, we should make the following pledge. Throughout the whole of today, I will remember bodhicitta. Eating, dressing, meditating, wherever I go, I will practice it constantly. Should it slip my mind, I will remind myself. Mindful of it, I will not allow myself to wander into states of anger, desire, or ignorance. We should make a concerted effort to keep this vow, and at night before going to sleep, we should examine ourselves as to how much we've been able to generate bodhicitta, how much we've been able to help others, and whether all our actions have been in accordance with the teachings. Confessing the day's faults and resolving that from the next day onwards, within 24 hours or a month or at least within a year, we will have some signs of improvement. We should steel ourselves so as not to be daunted by the work of abandoning defects. If during the day our actions have not been contrary to the teachings and we have maintained an altruistic attitude, then we should be happy, thinking, today has been a useful day. I have remembered what my teacher has taught me, and this is to accomplish his wishes. Tomorrow I will do better than today, and even better the day after. This is how to ensure the growth of our bodhicitta. And that is Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. Now, I don't know that we need to add any more to the commentaries on this slogan. It should be fairly obvious by now what it is referring to. So let's move on to the next slogan, which is train first in the easier practices. And Namkha Pal comments, if you feel that it's difficult to take on the miseries of others and to give up your own happiness and merits, recall that at the present you are training in these practices only on a mental level. When, due to acquaintance, you have gained prowess, actually engaging in giving and taking will not be difficult. Now, as Alan Wallace pointed out in his commentary to the slogan before this, we cannot just snap our fingers and suddenly we will be able to put everything we have learned into practice, and just as quickly it will all be perfected. It just doesn't work that way, unfortunately, and our minds are very stubborn, always wanting to return to what is familiar, even though it may be painful. So we have to be patient and take time to familiarize the mind with something more beneficial. Slowly, as it becomes more familiar with a new way of doing things, it will lose the attraction for what it was doing before. Now, again as Alan Wallace explained, we are very familiar with putting ourselves first in every situation and not caring so much about the well-being of others. This is our default mode, isn't it? If danger arises, we look after ourselves first, even if the danger is a minor threat. But this, from a Buddhist point of view, is where all our suffering originates. Our grasping as an autonomous, independent self, and then cherishing that as if it was the most important thing on the planet, nay, in the whole universe, has led us into the trap of unending suffering. It actually accomplishes what we don't want, not what we want. So how easy will it be, do you think, to change this attitude so that we automatically put others first. It's not at all easy. The mind, in its self-grasping and self-cherishing, does not want to change its ways, even though it's been to many teachings describing how destructive this can be. So we have to take things at a proper pace. Namgyal Pal advises doing the practices at a mental level first, and this is the method most of the Tibetan teachers advise. Listen, then contemplate, and meditate. First, listen to the teachings. In our context, first take in the teachings on mind training. Now, this doesn't mean just listening to them once and thinking we know them. Actually, the masters advise listening to the same teachings again and again, and like rereading a good book, we will get something new each time. Our understanding will steadily grow. Then, when we have a good understanding through the teachings, we continue to contemplate them to see if what we've learned and heard agrees with our experience and we can apply it. Even the Buddha said that if something does not agree with your experience, you shouldn't adopt it. And if we're not in a situation to apply it, that's not much use either. You may understand the benefit of prostrations, but if you have broken both your legs in an accident, you may have to find something else to practice. Finally, we meditate on what we've contemplated, so that it becomes so entrenched in the mind that we can easily act on it without thinking. We cannot expect to hear about bodhicitta, think it is wonderful, and then suddenly our life is filled with loving concern for others, and we can immediately put into practice the instruction of the second verse of the 8 verses of mind training. When in the company of others, I shall always consider myself the lowest of all, and from the depths of my heart hold others dear and supreme. This may be a bit beyond our capability in the beginning. Even while appreciating the immense value of bodhicitta, as soon as we encounter even a slightly difficult situation, we automatically go into fight or flight mode. And then afterwards, we berate ourselves severely for not having behaved patiently and disinterestedly. This just shows us how involved we are with self-grasping and self-cherishing. We don't even have enough compassion for ourselves. So it takes time to change our habits, not only mentally, but also physically. On blog.bufferapp.com, Walter Chen has written an interesting article on rewiring the brain to think positively, and he expands on what this slogan is teaching us. This is what he writes. Ever go through a phase where you feel like every day is a Monday? You wake up, you hit snooze. Then you hit snooze again. You just don't feel it. Yes, I know that negative emotions can eat away at my productivity, creativity, and decision-making skills. And yet, I have to admit that sometimes it's really difficult to reverse the course of a slump. The unfortunate superpower of the negative is that it has a stronger impact than the positive. In fact, negative impact of setbacks in your work is 3 times as powerful in affecting motivation than positive progress. It's just easier to remember the bad stuff that has happened to you during the day than the good. So why is it that our brains have such a negativity bias? The reason is quite simple. They're actually wired to pay more attention to negative experiences. It's a self-protective characteristic. We're scanning for threats from when we used to be hunters and gatherers. But such vigilance for negative information can cause a narrowing downward spiral and a negative feedback loop that doesn't reflect reality. Fortunately, we aren't doomed by our natural disposition towards negativity. What's amazing is that we have the ability to break out of that negative feedback loop, and we can actually rewire our brains to think positively. Understanding how the brain can refashion its own connections is the key to unlocking the durable power of positive thinking. And then he talks about the Tetris effect. For those who are electronically illiterate, Tetris is an electronic game involving small squares that fall down the playing part of the electronic device's screen in sets of 4, called tetrimenos. The 4 squares can be in any geometric configuration, a square, an L-shape, a straight line, and so on. The player manipulates the falling shapes so that when they land at the lowest point, They form a horizontal line of 10 units without any gaps. When such a line is created, it is destroyed, and all the blocks above the line will fall. When a certain number of lines are cleared, the game enters a new level. As the game progresses, each level causes the tetrimonos to fall faster, and the game ends when the stack of tetrimonos reaches the top of the playing field, and so no new ones are able to enter. Now, some of this description comes from Wikipedia. You can look it up if you want. Anyway, imagine sitting in front of your computer, tablet, or phone, watching and manipulating tetrimonos for hours on end. What happens to your brain is called the Tetris effect, and Walter Chen uses it to tell us about how our brains learn new things. He says, whether on a clunky computer or Game Boy or the latest mobile device, we all know the game's surreal ability to spill into real life. After you shut off the game, you still see those Tetris blocks falling in your mind's eye. You're grocery shopping, and you find yourself thinking about rearranging items on grocery shelves and carts in the parking lot. Somehow, your mind continues to play the game, even when you're physically not. Robert Stickgold, Harvard professor of psychiatry, noticed something similar after a day's hiking a mountain in Vermont. That night, he dreamt that he was still going through the motions of mountain hiking, clinging to rocks. Curious about this dream replay, he tried something. Stickgold got a group of college students of varying skill levels to play Tetris and sleep in the Harvard Sleep Lab. Over 60% of the study participants, including surprisingly those who suffered from amnesia, reported dreams of images of Tetris pieces falling, rotating, and fitting together. Interestingly, half the Tetris expert participants reported such Tetris dreams, while 75% of the novices did. The mind was continuing to work on making sense of the game during sleep. Chen says that a study from 2009 by Dr. Richard Heyer, professor emeritus at the Pediatric Neurology Division of the School of Medicine at the University of California, Irvine, and associates, found that playing Tetris can make the brain more efficient while increasing its cortex. Chen says, adolescent girls played the game for an average of 1.5 hours a week over 3 months. The cerebral cortex, or the gray matter, of the girls grew thicker, while brain activity in other areas decreased compared to when they'd started. Richard Heyer, who had previously found in a 1992 study that there was a Tetris learning effect in which the brain consumed less energy as mastery of the game arose, concluded, we think the brain is learning which areas not to use. As you learn the game, it becomes more automatic. Chen then continues, Heyer's 2009 study demonstrated how Tetris affected the brain's plasticity, or the brain's ability to change structurally, as the girls practiced and learned how to play the game. Neurons or nerve cells in your brain make connections, communicating through synapses. When you learn something, you change those neural connections. Every time you reactivate a circuit, synaptic efficiency increases and connections become more durable and easier to reactivate. Stickgold's study and subsequent research shows that sleep plays a role in this memory process. So, to sum up, whenever you do specific tasks over and over again, they take up less of your brain power over time. And that's pretty amazing, as this will be the basis for a huge opportunity to change our behavior for the better. He then asks, so how can we combat our negativity bias? And again quotes the positive Tetris effect. He says, indeed, it's quite simple. We can harness the brain's plasticity by training our brain to make positive patterns more automatic. When we practice looking for and being more aware of positive aspects of life, we fight off the brain's natural tendency to scan for and spot the negatives. Naturally, we bring ourselves into better balance. He then quotes Sean Acor, a researcher of happiness and human potential and a guest lecturer at Harvard, who has labeled the brain rewiring the positive Tetris effect, and says, according to Acor, with a positive Tetris effect, we can retrain the brain to scan for the good things in life, to help us see more possibility, to feel more energy, and succeed at higher levels. Yes, so something as trivial as the game of Tetris can have a scientifically measurable effect on people's brains and invade their dreams. If that's the case, the impact of practicing and retaining a more positive thinking pattern, especially on our well-being and happiness, can be even more powerful. We are basically trying to find an undiscovered path that, if walked once, makes us happy. The path being the synaptic connections in our brain, and then, because we enjoy it, we go along that path hundreds and hundreds of times. Slowly a track forms and becomes very clear and easier to walk every time. The best thing about such a practice is its long-term effects. In one study, people who did a three good things exercise for a week felt happier and less depressed after 1 month. The study then did the 3 month and 6 month follow-ups. Not surprisingly, the happiest participants were the ones who had continued the practice throughout. Chen says that it's like learning a foreign language. It will be the most difficult and unnatural feeling at the beginning. And yet, the rewards will make you feel unbelievably happier if you stick with it. He then lists a few of the ways Acor and others identified to rewire the brain for positivity. He says, at the end of each day, make a list of three specific good things that happened that day and reflect on what caused them to happen. The good things could be anything: bumping into an old friend, a positive remark from someone at work, a pretty sunset. Celebrating small wins also has a proven effect of powering motivation and igniting joy. As you record your good things daily, the better you will get and feel. Now, doesn't that correspond to celebrating acts done with bodhicitta during the day in line with our morning resolution? Then he says, take a minute to say thanks or recognize someone for their efforts, from friends and family to people at work. A great way to go about this is by sending one daily email to someone. Can be your old school teacher, whose advice you are now appreciating every day, a co-worker, or someone you've only met. Third is make sure you act with kindness. He recommends even just making someone smile or doing something thoughtful, buying someone a coffee. And finally, mindfulness, paying attention to the present moment without judgment. Opening our awareness beyond the narrowness of negativity can help bring back more balance and positivity into the picture, he says. Now, if these simple daily acts can have so much positive effect, just imagine what the development of bodhicitta can do. But we must stop here as time is now up. Thanks for being with the program today, and I hope you'll tune in again next time. Please dedicate, as usual, to gaining enlightenment for all beings. Thanks, and goodbye.